Session number 1888, Mr. Frederick Hutchinson, Reel 1.
When did you join the Navy and why, please?
I joined the Navy in 1937 as a boy in HMS Ganges. It was just an interest that I wanted to join the Navy after I left school. No particular reason other than that the Navy appealed to me.
Where did you come from?
I was originally born in Bedford.
What was your training like on Ganges?
Very strict. In those days, it was an 18-month course. You started off in the train establishment, and the work that we had to do was very, very strict. The discipline was very strong, but nevertheless, after 18 months, you were a fully trained seaman. And I consider that in spite of all the discipline that you had to put up with, and it was strict, it never did me any harm at all. And it certainly helped me in my life throughout my working life.
Can you give an example of the strictness?
The strictness was that every morning you used to get up at 5:30 in the morning. You had a cup of cocoa and a very hard biscuit, which was a ship's biscuit. You then had to dress in shorts and singlet. In the winter you were allowed to wear a sweater, but then you fell in outside of your mess. You immediately doubled to the parade ground, and the first thing you had to do was to go over the Shotley mast, and the last one over had to go back over again. From then, you had to double around the parade ground and finish by stripping off completely naked and one length of the swimmer bath before you ever were allowed to have breakfast. Punishment was very severe. A whole mess could be punished for some minor misdemeanor of one of the men or the boys, and you then were forced to carry one of the field guns that they use at the field gun training at Olympia every year. The boys had to pull one of those up and down what was known as Shotley Hill or Laundry Hill. And you had to double up and down with this. The more serious offences, you had to double around the parade ground with a rifle over your head, and that would go on for an hour. I've actually seen boys collapse through sheer exhaustion, but nevertheless, you were made to do this, and it was considered nothing untoward. Fortunately, I never had the punishment to have to do that, but I certainly had to do the Laundry Hill gun crew punishment. Another thing that they used to make you do was in the summer you used to have to carry your kit bag, which weighed quite a lot, your hammock and an oilskin, and the beds used to stand on wooden chocks because they were highly polished. That was part of the thing, to keep the messes absolutely polished, beautifully clean. And they used to make you fill your pockets on the oilskins with these wooden chocks, which must have weighed about a pound each, and then double around the parade ground wearing this oilskin, and carry your kit bag and hammock, one on each shoulder, for an hour as a punishment. So in all, the punishment, as you can see, was very, very strict. But nevertheless, it didn't hurt you. You came out. You were quite capable of taking on Joe Lewis by the time you'd finished.
So you didn't resent it?
I didn't resent it at all. You did at the time, but then when leave came up, it was all forgotten, and it was hard sometimes to when it's time to go back off leave, but it didn't do any harm.
What was the first ship that you joined?
My first ship was HMS Ramillies, which was a battleship, one of the R-class battleships. She was a training ship, and all boys from HMS Ganges and other establishments were expected to serve a certain amount of time on Ramillies as a training ship. We did cruises around the coast, and you did all necessary seaman training.
You just went in to be an ordinary seaman, did you?
Well, I joined as a boy. I hadn't got any plans of what I wanted to be at the particular time when I did join. You were asked to consider what you wanted to be while you were doing your training. You could either be a signalman, or a wireless operator, a seaman, whatever. I chose to be a seaman. It interested me, the type of work that was carried out, and I became a boy seaman. Then I became an ordinary seaman, and gradually worked up from that.
What do you remember about the declaration of war?
The declaration of war, I was in on HMS Resolution, which was another R-class battleship, which I was transferred from when the war seemed imminent, and I became a buoy fuse setter on one of the anti-aircraft guns on board. And we were in Weymouth at the time the war was declared. I can vividly remember that all just the 2 or 3 days before the war, the ship, which was immaculate in those days, all brasswork, highly polished, enamel paints, and the whole ship's company was employed in covering all the brasswork, all the enamel paints, all the decks had to be painted, which were highly scrubbed, with a matte dark grey paint, which seemed criminal at the time. But nevertheless, it proved to be necessary.
How did you react when you heard that we were at war?
To be quite honest, it didn't sort of sink into me that we're at war. I knew that I was in the Navy for the war. I think I was too young to realise what was coming. It was one of those things that you accepted you were in the Navy, and therefore you got to accept what was coming. But I don't think at the time when the war actually broke out, and even when the first air raid was announced, I closed up on the 4-inch gun. Even then, you didn't realise what was involved in wartime, even though you were trained for actually in for war.
Can you tell me what kind of a ship Resolution was to live on and to work on?
Resolution wasn't a very good ship to live on. The seamen, all the stokers or whatever's accommodation was not first class by any means. According to today's standards, you slept in a hammock. You lived in a mess which was just a wooden table, wooden seats, and really that was all. The decks were made of corcosine. They had to be scrubbed every day to keep them clean. Once the war broke out, the ship's company was increased considerably to allow for various gun screws to be backed up for watch keeping systems, and so accommodation became very, very scarce, and at times it was hard to even find somewhere to sling a hammock.
Was the ship verminous? Did you have...
Oh no, nothing like that, until we went out during the war and we went out to West Africa, and we were on convoy runs to Sierra Leone Freetown base, and then with the fruit that was coming on board, we used to get a considerable amount of cockroaches. One funny incident happened. Gas masks were never used while we were abroad because there was no fear of gas at that particular time. And the gas masks were stowed in lockers. And when I came home on leave after one of the trips out to Sierra Leone, after we'd been out there for several months, we had to wear gas masks. We just took them out of the lockers. I went home on leave, got indoors, and my mother-in-law at the time said, "Oh, can I see your gas mask?" So I pulled it out from its case, never having looked at it at all, and out jumped about 30 cockroaches, which frightened the life out of her. But that was one of the things that was quite amusing during the war. But that the first part of the war, I was involved on resolution on the Atlantic convoys. And one of the very interesting things that we did was to carry a first consignment of gold to Canada. I remember when we loaded it in Liverpool, all we had was one sergeant of the police standing at the bottom of the gangway checking the cases as we carried them on board. I remember them being very, very heavy to carry. And when we got over to Halifax, we were greeted by armed, mounted police, ordinary police, by the dozen, which made it seem quite ironic, really, that just one policeman could do it in England and they needed so many over in the Canada.
That was 39, was it?
That's in 1939.
Was the Norwegian campaign the first time that you were in action?
Yes. We went over to Narvik just before the Battle of Narvik. We were involved in helping the French army to land. We carried a considerable number of small French army tanks, very small tanks, which used to carry two soldiers. We landed those. I can recall them going ashore and charging up onto the beach to attack the Germans, which were, we could see quite plainly. But the worst part of it was the fact that during the campaign, while we were there, there was never any darkness. And 24 hours a day, we were subject to very heavy bombing. And lying in the fields, the planes used to come over and they were over the top of the mountains bombing you before you really had time to take evasive action. But it got so bad in the end that they were bringing the 4-inch shells, which were carried in cases of two, alongside the ship, brought by a little Norwegian fishing boat, being transferred straight up into the guns and fired immediately, and the empty cases returned. And in the end, the very, very final attack that we had got no ammunition left at all. All the 4-inch anti-aircraft ammunition had been used. The planes were coming over on doing a high-level bombing, and the only armour that we got that we opened fire with was the multiple pom-poms, which were completely out of range, but nevertheless, it was just an act of defiance by the ship because we got no other ammunition to use.
Presumably it was difficult to manoeuvre the ship.
The ship would remain at anchor at all times during those bombing raids because the fjords were so narrow that there wasn't room to manoeuvre. You just had to lie there and take whatever came.
Was your action station on the 4-inch gun?
Yes, I was a fuse setter on the starboard 4-inch gun. And we got very, very efficient with our gun drill. And we were at times not even allowed to leave the gun. All our food had to be brought up. We were only allowed snatches of sleep between raids, which made it very, very tiring. I can recall when we left Norway and we got back to Portsmouth. We had an air raid there, and half the gun's crew were so tired that they were still asleep and had to be woken, even after coming all the way from Norway.
What does a fuse setter do on a 4-inch gun?
Well, the fuse setter, what happens is they bring the shells out of the ready-use lockers, they place them onto the fuse setter. The fuse setter, which was my job, then sets a preset fuse, which comes from the 4-inch director, who is taking the range of the attacking aircraft. And you move two levers, which sets the fuse, which is then taken and placed into the barrel of the guns.
How quickly can you do all that?
Oh, you could. We were working up after the Norway campaign to about 25 rounds per minute, which was quite exceptional. But we'd fired so many rounds that we got so efficient with the method of loading that we were considered extremely good.
Was it possible to have accidents doing the job?
Oh, yes. One thing what I remember that used to happen was that if you had a misfire on one of the guns, that the shell failed to fire, the normal procedure, safety procedure, was you had to wait half an hour before the shell could be removed from the gun in case it was a hang fire. But because of the heavy attacks, it was then decided that the shells must be removed immediately. And the gun was opened, the breech was opened, the shell was withdrawn and then immediately thrown over the side. One very funny thing that happened, although it wasn't funny at the time, was as I was the fuse setter on the starboard gun, which was closest to the guardrails, it was my job to throw the last person to throw the shell overboard. And I remember throwing one shell overboard, only to hear a terrific scream come from down below. Looked over the side, and there was one of the ship's boats tied up alongside, and the shell had landed in the boat. But it was one of those things that it was done so quickly, you didn't have time to even think or even look to see if there was anything. You just had to get rid of the shell so that the next one could be loaded.
What else do you remember happening at Narvik?
Well, I remember very clearly the day we were bombed. We were still trying to carry out a certain amount of discipline, and we used to parade the Royal Marine Band for the colours at 8 o'clock every morning. And on this particular morning, the band was marching up and down the quarterdeck ready for colours at 8 o'clock. And this German aircraft came over and dropped these bombs, catching the band unawares on the quarterdeck, which immediately did a wild scatter to drums, and bugles were left all over the quarterdeck while the band disappeared down below. But the bomb hit on the starboard quarter. It did quite a considerable amount of damage, and it killed one man. But one man was very lucky, because he was coming up the steps leading onto the quarterdeck, and the blast of the bomb lifted the ladder with him on it and landed him on top of Y turret, and he got away unscathed.
Was there much damage done to the Resolution?
Yeah, she was quite badly damaged during with the bomb, but not enough to put her out of action. It was mainly the Marines' mess deck that was damaged. and some of the officers' quarters. The cabins were ruined.
Any other damage to Resolution at Narvi?
No other damage at all, apart from the one bomb. But that was right at the end of the campaign. We were very lucky. We were bombed so much that it seemed the Germans weren't quite as efficient at bombing ships as they were on the land, because the amount of bombs and the amount of air raids that we had, it seemed impossible with the ship lying at anchor that she wasn't hit far more than she was.
How much shelling of the shore did you do?
We did quite a lot of heavy bombarding with the 15-inch guns on at Narvik and various other ports along the coast, mainly to support the British troops that were ashore in the Norwegian campaign. But when we were bombarding with the 15-inch, you didn't really see anything at all, because the range that we were firing was probably anything between 10 and 15 miles. So you were liaising with the army with the heavy bombarding. But we occasionally used to use the 4-inch anti-aircraft guns, which were a dual-purpose gun. They could be used as a low-angle gun or a high-angle gun. And they occasionally we had reason to use the 4-inch to bombard troops, which we could see on the shore, and of army vehicles, German army vehicles.
Did you see anything of damage to other ships in the Navy at Narvi?
Yes, we had the HMS Eskimo, which was torpedoed during the Narvik campaign, and she was brought alongside the Resolution, and she got her bows blown completely off, and you could even see some of the dead still on board. They brought all the casualties onto the Resolution, because we were a capital ship, so we had quite a large sick bay and doctors on board. So apart from that, there was other minor things, like some of the smaller ships that had casualties caused by a blast or shrapnel, and the wounded were brought on board. Some of the army personnel were brought on board wounded. One thing that did happen was that the 4-inch guns shot down one of the German aircraft that was attacking, and we landed, we saw the plane actually crash onto the beach, and we sent a detachment of the Royal Marines ashore to examine the aircraft, only to find that the pilot was unhurt and he was brought back on board. I can remember him very well. He was a very arrogant German. He was only young. I shouldn't think his age was much more than about 18 or 19. He stepped on board and immediately gave the Nazi salute. I remember it quite plainly, only to be completely disciplined by the Royal Marines that were guarding him.
Oh.
Well, they gave him quite a hefty slap with one of the butts of the rifles just to bring him into line.
Now, I think that you were with the Resolution on the attack on the French fleet in North Africa in 1914.
Yes, that's correct. We attacked at the both of the positions, at Mers El Kabir and at Dakar. At Mers El Kabir, we were one of the first vessels to open fire, and we actually attacked the Bretagne, the French battleship Bretagne, which was sunk. It was a long day. I remember it very, very well, as we had quite a grandstand view being on the upper deck as the 4-inch guns crew, and we were lying fairly close to the harbour, so we could see all what was going on. It was quite an experience, that one of those things that just had to happen during the war, but was obviously it was necessary. I remember the Hood chasing the big French battleship, I can see her steaming away, chasing her, but she got away. And then after that, we moved on to Dhaka. But that didn't go very well for Resolution. She was torpedoed by a French submarine. And although nobody was injured, the ship was very, very badly damaged and had to be towed by HMS Barham into Freetown.
Can you describe that torpedoing?
Well, all I remember of it, it hit on the port side, and the only thing I do recall seeing was a huge sheet of water going up on the port side, which immediately came down, and we were completely swamped with the water. We immediately thought that we would have heavy casualties, but remarkably, nobody was injured at all, nobody killed.
How did you all feel on board the ship about having to attack the French in the summer of 1940?
Well, it was one of these things that you knew that if the Germans got hold of those ships, it was going to cause a lot of trouble for the Royal Navy. So it was one of these things that had to be done. You knew that if the Germans got hold of them, you'd got to fight them anyway. And it was far better that we got rid of them at the time to prevent the Germans getting hold of them.
How many casualties did you have from the torpedoing?
None at all. Absolutely none at all, which was a remarkable thing. Probably the reason was that where the torpedo hit, which was on the port side, it was part of the boiler room, which took the force of the explosion. But the old R-class battleships used to have a torpedo bulge, which took most of the shock. And the fact that all the ship's company at the time were closed up at action stations meant that there's very few people down below, which probably saved all the casualties.
Were you still on the 4-inch gun as your action
station? I was, yes.
Now, you were telling me earlier, off the record, about how you became a ship's diver. Was that soon after this?
Yes, that happened after we were torpedoed at Dhaka and we were towed to Freetown. And I was detailed off to become one of the old hand pump that the divers used to use as the pumping party. At the particular time, we had two divers on board Resolution because all capital ships from cruisers up above used to carry two divers as part of the ship's company. But one of the divers was retained. He'd finished his official time in the Navy, but because of the war, he was retained, and he didn't want to carry on the diving, because there was a lot to do with the heavy...